Hello and welcome to a podcast series from iBioMD on business and biodiversity. Why is biodiversity important for business? How can business engage in nature impact? What's the latest that's happening in this space? In this podcast, we talk with brilliant and passionate people working at the cutting edge of business and nature to find out some of these answers. My name is Adrian Deliker. I'm a researcher at the Center for Sustainable and Inclusive Business at IMD. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Mariana Sarmiento, the founder and CEO of Terrazos, a Colombia-based company developing innovative solutions for environmental conservation and restoration. Mariana founded Terrazos in 2013 and has since helped conserve or restore over 50,000 hectares in Colombia. Terrazos is also a pioneer in the new market for voluntary biodiversity credits, and Mariana is at the forefront of the intellectual and practical ramifications of this new tool for nature-positive impact. I've enjoyed our past conversations. I love hearing you speak at events, and I'm delighted to have you on this podcast today. Welcome, Mariana.
Thank you, Adrian, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about the history behind Terrazos. What motivated you to found it, and what have you learned in this time?
So maybe the first thing to mention is that, you know, Terrazos means sustainable landscapes in Spanish. So territorios sostenibles. And in that sense, you know, when I started Terrazos, it was very much about how can we create models by which we have sustainability in the form of economic sustainability, environmental sustainability, and social sustainability. So that's what we aim to do. And in that process, we found kind of a challenge and an opportunity, which is what has driven our business. And it's the reality of a lot of money that needs to be spent by companies in biodiversity because of regulatory requirements that wasn't being spent. So we said, okay, how can we facilitate this and deliver value both for the private sector and, you know, for society as a whole? And that's where we embarked on this mission to begin to create solutions for that challenge.
So what kind of solutions? Am I right to think that you're engaged heavily in biodiversity offsets within the regulatory framework of Colombia?
Yeah, that's right. You know, the reality of this issue today in Colombia, for example, is that there's about 150,000 hectares that are pending in terms of biodiversity offsets. And these is compensation after the mitigation hierarchy has been applied, and that needs to be delivered. And it hasn't been delivered for many reasons. And we said, okay, we're going to create a solution because there's a bunch of companies that are in debt with society, with the country, and that also have operational risks if they don't comply. So how can we create a solution? And then that's where habitat banks resulted. So I think, you know, the easiest way to always understand these issues is with examples. So let's think about a road, or let's think about energy transmission line or a mine. These are companies that generate damages. They're unavoidable damages, and they need to compensate that. And Colombia has a strong regulation in terms of making sure that companies have to avoid and then repair if they've damaged something, but also compensate. And you have to compensate 2 to 10 hectares, depending on the type of ecosystem that you've impacted. And you need to compensate within the same watershed and in the same type of habitat that was impacted. So that's, in a nutshell, what biodiversity offsets are. And the reality is that these are permanent impacts, and we're trying to deliver as permanent a solution as we can. And what we do is we find sites that need restoration or conservation, depending on the type of ecosystem that we're working on. And we set up projects for 30 years. Other countries, it's in perpetuity. Colombia has land titling and land regulation that doesn't allow us to do it in that way. And within that habitat bank, let's say we have 100 hectares, each hectare becomes a credit. So if you have to compensate 100 hectares of dry tropical forest, then companies can see if there's a habitat bank in that watershed, in that habitat, and buy 100 credits.
So you're essentially buying from a habitat bank, which guarantees the quality, is that it?
Exactly. So our value proposition to companies is we're in a position to be able to deliver the best outcome that we possibly can in terms of biodiversity conservation and uplift, but also deliver compliance. So we'll take on the responsibility of reporting all the issues associated with that biodiversity offset to the agency. And that way we minimize, you know, some of the errors that might be in, ensure that there's consistency between what's happening on the ground and what's being reported to the agencies.
Okay, so this is all compliance driven, basically. So is there a logical leap from compliance driven biodiversity offsets and voluntary biodiversity credits? How did you enter that new market? What was the logic behind that?
So two things. One thing is that as we began to talk about what habitat banks were and the sites that we were looking for, we began to get demand to look at some amazing sites that needed conservation, but that unfortunately wouldn't be able to fit that compliance market because they weren't in habitats that were being heavily impacted by the industries that are required to do compensation, but that nevertheless, there was significant land use change because of other types of activities that are doing it. So for example, we have one project today, which is where we ended up, you know, piloting biodiversity credits, which is a landscape that is heavily impacted by land use change due to agriculture products that are being exported to Europe. So avocados, some exotic fruits, et cetera. And we said, how do we package this product? How do we package this conservation project in a way that there could be other types of payers that could pay for the conservation of these landscapes, which is essential for maintaining these economic activities? It was very much problem driven. Right. And in that shaping of that product, we use the same template of the compliance market in the sense that it's still a 30-year project. It's all performance-based payments. So credits are only released for sale once ecological and management outcomes have been met.
When is that? Is that after like 1 year or 5 years or?
One of the things that we've done in order to create our model is really learn from what's happening in other places of the world, right? So we looked a lot at the Australian model and then the US model for wetland and conservation banks. And it ends up looking very much like a pension fund, which means that the conservation project or the restoration project is capital intensive in the first 5 to 10 years. And then after that, you're maintaining that. So we are determining key management and ecological outcomes that are very relevant to achieving the stability of that ecosystem in the long term. Those become payment milestones. And then when we get those payments, a percentage of that payment goes into a sinking endowment, which is what sustains the project for 30 years. So again, very much like a pension fund, the working life of the habitat bank is the first 10 to 15 years, which is when it generates the income as it achieves critical milestones. And then the last 15 years of the project are funded through those savings that were allocated when it was generating revenue.
I want to jump in here because it's fascinating to hear you. And I'm hearing sort of one side of the equation, which is the supply. So there's a lot of details about how you package these, whether they're their credits or projects, et cetera. But I'm really curious about the demand side. Like, who's buying these? Are there primarily companies? But also beyond that, are they sort of like new actors? Essentially, is the way that these conservation projects are packaged, the way you've described them, does that open the door to new buyers? And what is the typical kind of buyer? What reactions are you getting from the demand side?
So you know, I can speak, I think, on behalf of Terrazos. We actually had a really interesting conversation yesterday with somebody else from Australia, and we have similar insights. So I think this will be useful. You know, one, there's clearly that demand from those sectors that generate large impacts. You know, there is something to be delivered to those industries, right? In terms of compensation requirements or beyond compensation requirements are going to increase. And we're going to see that because what's happening is there's a regulatory requirement and investors or banks are asking to go beyond compliance. So there's a need there to be able to make a coherent product that can deliver both for the compliance market and for the demands that other stakeholders in their process may have. And those are transactions that are happening right now. Now, the compliance sector, it's in a way a bulk type of sale, right? These are companies that need anywhere from 20 hectares in terms of compensation to 10,000, right? To 15,000. So it's that level of money and it's those kinds of transactions. So when we decided to test this voluntary product, and part of the feedback that we were getting from the companies that would be interested to fund conservation in a real meaningful way was, this is kind of my budget, right? And it's either a marketing budget or it's a CSR budget. So it was kind of a backtracking exercise. Okay, what's the budget? What's your willingness to pay? And how can we package the product in a way that meets that goal? So in that segment, you know, we're seeing construction companies, we're seeing tourism companies, and some of the companies that, again, have compliance requirements, but that want to do more through their CSR programs. And then there is another really interesting segment, which is that small and medium-sized company, which typically doesn't even have a budget, but it doesn't mean that they would not be willing to invest in something like this or to contribute to some kind of environmental cause. And those are small transactions. So you need to still be able to package that same product in a way where they can say, this year I spent $10,000 in this contribution, and they can tell a story to their clients or to their employees. There clearly is a question in terms of, you know, where does it make sense to spend the time and the resources creating those markets? And how do we do that in a good way? I think we're also seeing, you know, as the conversation about carbon gets a little bit fuzzy and muddled, then we're seeing a shift to a conversation about nature.
So you said before, it's good to talk in examples. Talk in examples. You have a hectare somewhere, you're selling it as a biodiversity credit. Can a company also claim that as carbon, or are you working yourself to kind of onboard on the carbon market? What's your template to navigate those two distinct markets, or is it sort of emerging as a single market?
So I think, you know, two things. One, you know, what is a carbon credit good for? And carbon credits are created to be able to compensate for emissions that already occurred, right? So it's kind of a retrospective look. When you're investing in biodiversity, you're investing in the future, right? So you're making a contribution today to be able to sustain a landscape for the next 30 years. So I think that's an important distinction. But at the same time, then when you're in that biodiversity credit, at least in the way that we have structured those units, the carbon is embedded. So you could talk about a biodiversity unit or credit that has a carbon co-benefit. And it's a carbon co-benefit that could be accounted for by the company that buys it. We aren't stacking, right? So in our projects, you wouldn't have a carbon credit and on top of that, a biodiversity credit. We are pricing our biodiversity credits based on at least the cost of implementation management plus the cost of capital. So the discussion about financial additionality becomes really fuzzy. And we think that's a clear and transparent way of doing it. But I think what's important is that, you know, executives and buyers and even suppliers understand what's the problem that they're targeting. Are they targeting, you know, that need of the company to decarbonize or that net zero goal? Or is the problem that is being addressed is something about sustaining landscapes where there is some kind of dependency or where there have been impacts and we want to begin to create more resilient landscapes and build regenerative economies? I think the rationale for buying one thing or the other is different.
You talked about small companies, large companies wanting to buy some of these credits, presumably sometimes for CSR, sometimes for marketing. Why can't they do that with traditional NGOs?
I think the challenge that the conservation community has had and we've all had is, you know, that traceability. When the money is given and what are the direct outcomes that are achieved with that money in the landscapes, right? So biodiversity credits have the potential to be able to provide that solution and that transparency that I think many people have been waiting for. You can write a check to an NGO and that'll continue to happen. But here, I think there's an added value of transparency and traceability. And also the magnitude. Not everybody can write a check for $1 million to a big NGO, right? You have some companies that the best they can do is $10,000 a year. So I think one is, here's a solution where we can create traceability. And the way that these units are supposed to work is that they're performance-based payments, right? So you can only sell credits once you've achieved milestones that are verifiable. So it also aligns everybody's interest in achieving those milestones. And there's so much money that has been spent on conservation projects, and we're still waiting for the results. So I think this model is very much needed. And conservation NGOs have a role to play. We partner with NGOs all the time. They oftentimes have excellent work on the ground and networks, and they can also participate in this market. In fact, you know, what we think is that this market can disintermediate a little bit conservation finance, and it creates fantastic opportunities for more local NGOs to be able to create these projects, put them together, and then deliver. The truth of the matter is that conservation finance is controlled by a few organizations around the world, right? And so how do we make sure that the funding is getting to those communities that are doing the really hard work? Because doing conservation work, doing restoration work in the landscapes where we need it the most is really difficult. And it's not just planting a tree, right? It's how do you set up governance systems in these landscapes to be able to create and sustain these projects? And local actors have to be owners of these projects for that to really take place. Otherwise, we continue to repeat this structure where local communities and local organizations are the beneficiaries of the funding, but not really the owners of the project.
In carbon, it's easy. There's a simple measure, CO2, maybe a proxy measure, but CO2. A lot of people are scrambling to try and figure out a similar number for biodiversity. Do you believe in that? Is it possible? Is it desirable?
I think there's been a confusion in terms of what is that metric that everybody understands so that we can begin to have a common language. What are the indicators that I need to use in order to be able to show that the project is moving in the right direction? And also then what is the methodology? And everything is kind of in the same soup box, which is confusing because not everybody understands biodiversity. But I think there is an underlying agreement, which is at the end of the day, we need to be able to account for hectares under management, time, and the quality of those hectares, right? Like it's not just poor quality habitat. It needs to be habitat that has improved in its quality, or that we're maintaining the quality of that habitat, which delivers essential goods and services. The first two are fairly straightforward, hectares and time. And the second part, which is the quality, is something that you need to measure with indicators. So I think little by little, as we become more pragmatic, you're going to see more methodologies represented. And then you're going to see different, you know, different projects being measured with different indicators, because the ecosystems require that. It's not the same to measure biodiversity in a grassland than it is a tropical forest.
So the convention of the parties on the UN Convention on Biological Diversity was in Colombia this year. You were there. There was a lot of expectation. What was the mood like? What have you come to expect of these meetings? How would you describe the people's state in that COP? And maybe specifically also for biodiversity credits, what's needed from actors like the UN Convention of Parties? And what do you expect the next couple of years? Do you expect a boom in biodiversity credits and demand?
So when we talk about these meetings, and the way that I approach these meetings is, it's always really interesting to see who ends up showing up. And what we saw at COP16 is that we saw a private sector that showed up, not with much to show or to pledge, but with a genuine, I think, interest in figuring out how they participate in this process. We saw the multilateral banks all there, and I think that'll be very interesting to see the role that they play in nature markets more broadly. The feasibility of the investments that multilateral banks make all depends on the stability of the countries in which they invest in, and also the resilience of the ecosystems that in a way can affect the infrastructure that they're building and the projects that they're financing. So they had a strong presence. And then there was clearly a large NGO base, indigenous peoples base, and governments were there in a quiet role. That was kind of my sense. So I think it's yet to be seen what's really the impact of COP, but businesses is listening and they want to participate, and they're saying, okay, help me create the business case for investment. And there are people that are really asking, and I think there is room for many of us to be able to help the private sector in that journey of, hey, let's build this. How do we build this business case so that we can get money flowing? In terms of bio credits, I think you're still going to have different opinions, but I think the gap is so large that new instruments and tools are welcome. And COP16, I think, reaffirmed that there is a space for biodiversity credits or units, as long as there's, you know, as long as there is what they say, you know, high integrity attached to them, which in my opinion, not only are we discussing issues of financial sustainability and permanence and technical rigor, but how are nature custodians really active participants of this market shaping and process, but also owners of these projects. So I think that was also clear from what came out of COP16. As geopolitics are reconfigured, it becomes all that more important for national governments to create their own systems to leverage private capital to fund conservation. All the Amazon countries, for example, they've been relying on international aid to be able to sustain conservation programs or to create conservation programs. And I think what's clear is that needs to change. And how do we begin to change that? Well, we need all countries to have biodiversity compensation policies for impacts that are being created domestically. I'm optimistic about nature markets in the sense that now it's extremely obvious